getting upset about the election. This is the nonviolent direct action began on Monday. 25 people were arrested. And more on all of this later. This has been Air Cascadia. Thor, Monday, November 10th, 2014. Kate Welch, engineer of the show. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Hunter. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to announce the opening of Convergence, an audio documentary and sonic artwork by our artist-in-residence, Tessie Word. The opening will be Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. Convergence examines the historical, environmental, and sociological ramifications of living in an imminent ecological disaster area, the tsunami zones of the Oregon coast near the mouth of the Columbia River. Through the use of phonographic recordings, radio transmissions, and original music, Convergence explores and interprets the cultural implications and the psychic terrain of daily life in the tsunami zone. Again, that's Convergence by KBOO Artist-in-Residence Tessie Word, opening Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. At 16.8 million acres, the Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska is America's largest national forest and contains some of the most intact expanses of temperate rainforest remaining in the world today. But for decades, the Tongass has been also heavily logged for old-growth timber. This morning, we talk about the need to step up protections for the Tongass and transition from old growth to second growth logging. My guest is Dominic Della Sala with the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks, Barbara. It's great to be on your show again.
Right. Well, I want to start by talking about what makes the Tongass so special and, let's say, what sets it apart from some of the national forests we're more familiar with in Oregon, let's say like the Mount Hood National Forest up here or the Siskiyou National Forest down your way.
Yeah, sure. I've been going back and forth to the Tongass now since the early 1990s because there's just no place like it in the temperate world. And if you can imagine being placed in a time capsule and going back to what the Pacific Northwest must have been like, 100 years or so ago, that's what it's like on the Tongass in terms of we still have relatively intact temperate rainforest. It's one of only six areas globally that can boast that. There's still significant old growth, and that old growth is storing about 80 times Alaska's carbon dioxide emissions in those giant trees. So it's a great place to store carbon dioxide from the burning of our fossil fuel emissions. And there's just no place like it in terms of the salmon. It's like a rush hour for salmon on those rivers. They're just backed up with salmon trying to cram their way through the streams to spawn. And, you know, we just don't see that anymore in the lower 48 in the Pacific Northwest. So there's an opportunity there to do something extraordinary and remarkably different than what we've done in the Pacific Northwest, which, you know, in the 1990s was in a crisis mode because we overlogged the older forests.
Well, there has been old growth logging going on in the Tongass, though. Is that true?
That's correct. And the opportunity that exists now is to create a more responsible forestry industry that is not logging the old trees, but we have reduced the logging footprint to sites that were logged in the 1950s or 60s that are ready again to be logged, and it's a much smaller footprint, and it would be the small trees, not the big old growth trees that have all those values that I mentioned.
Well, I was looking at some of the articles that you sent me about this issue, and one of the arguments that's being made is that building practices today do not require old-growth logs. But in the article, it describes the kinds of wood products that are being used, and some people would go, well, I don't want laminate wood, or I don't want particle board. I want to have, like, you know, boards, real boards in my house for siding or for the structure of the house. So Is there a way to still get those larger pieces of wood that we're accustomed to, especially those of us who live in old homes in the Northwest, and still not be logging old growth trees?
Yes, I think there is. And, you know, we've just got to accept that we've got to have a smaller footprint in terms of logging. Otherwise, we will compromise all those other values that are associated with those bigger trees: clean water, salmon, wildlife habitat. So there is a way around that, and if you don't like laminated, there's also a number of companies that will go into buildings and pull out those big timbers as those buildings are either being destroyed or renovated and modified. So that kind of so-called salvage of building material is also available for purchase. But, you know, and we just can't cut those 200 to 1,000-year-old trees anymore without losing those values. Now, the other thing I'll mention is that in some places, these trees grow so fast and so big within 5 or 6 decades that, you know, they're not just tiny trees. So you can still get the kind of finished product out of these smaller trees. You know, it's not as great as the big trees, but they tend to have clear grain wood because you don't have a lot of the knots that you get in those old growth trees that, you know, pretty much have defects in them too.
Actually, is a, I guess, a debate about the aesthetics of wood with knots, and we have an old dining room with wainscoting, and it has it's very knotty. People were telling me, you don't want to strip this and, you know, refinish it because it's got knots in it. You want to put clear vertical grain wood in there, and we kept our knots, and we're very happy with them. But also, those trees were cut down probably in 1900, and that sort of makes me think about the difference in the need that we have for the forest and the need that the forests have for us now compared to 100 years ago. And how would what do you think has changed in terms of mentality, and why is there even a discussion going on right now about stopping clear cutting or stopping old growth logging, or really curtailing old growth logging in the Tongass?
You know, I think the public has generally moved on about that and recognized that these forests have so many important values that we get from them, the services, the benefits that they provide in terms of aesthetics, clean air, fisheries, clear water. All of that is being recognized by the public, and at the same time, we do need wood. And I think there is a way forward on this that wasn't available to the Pacific Northwest, and that's, you know, let's get out of the old forest and let's start to look at a smaller and more responsible logging footprint that doesn't take the trees that have the highest ecological and social value.
Well, it seems to me that recycling, which has become such a buzzword in the last 20 years or so, and we think a lot about recycling all kinds of materials, particularly metals and glass, but recycling wood is something that seems to be limited here in Portland to places like the Rebuilding Center, and it's still kind of a hippie thing to do. So I wonder, how do we sort of mainstream the concept of I need some old growth timber, and so I'm going to go harvest it from an old building as opposed to from an old forest?
Right. I think it's just a matter of continuing the message about how important it is for these trees to remain vertical and to do what they're doing best, which is providing us with all of these ecosystem benefits that we get out of the forest, but we may not be as aware of. And so we've got to look at alternatives to getting our wood needs met, either by using smaller trees that are the result of more responsible management, or recycling, or going into buildings and pulling that material out, or using alternatives to wood products. There are ways to get through this and still have these incredibly important forests for not only us, but, you know, for the next seven generations.
Well, one thing that I find interesting about this discussion about the Tongass is that it seems like nobody is saying that you can continue to cut old growth trees in the Tongass the way they have been. And that even the Forest Service is proposing to shift from old growth to second growth. The debate seems to be not so much making that shift, but how quickly the shift is made. So I wanted, first of all, to talk about why is even the Forest Service, which is happily cut clear and clear cut old growth forests in the lower 48 for decades, what is shifting there? And then how do you push the paradigm even further?
You know, I think we had a successful example with the Siuslaw National Forest in Oregon, albeit it happened pretty late in the game, and there isn't much old growth left, but they did make the transition in the 1990s to get out of old growth logging. There was some great leadership. They saw the writing on the wall and the fact that they were bumping into litigation and appeals every time they put up an old growth timber sale. They weren't getting the volume anyhow. And so I think the lesson that was learned in the Clinton administration has been building about the need to protect these older forests for their ecological values, and you're not going to get those trees to the mill without a big fight, so why go there? And so I think that's what Secretary Vilsack and others have seen. It's just a question of when and not if they make that transition.
So what is their when, and how does that contrast with what your when is?
Well, the Forest Service is saying they need 10 to 15 years of additional old-growth logging. And this is a lot of old-growth logging, by the way, that would occur on the Tongass. And they're calling it bridgewood. So they need a bridge between old-growth and second-growth, thinking that the second growth trees are not going to be available in time to have a viable industry. We think they could make that transition. They can start it right now. And within 5 years, they could pretty much be weaned off on all of the industrial scale old growth logging. And the way we did that is we took a look at the Forest Service data, and they've got more young growth out there than they think they do, and that transition can occur a lot faster than what they're saying.
So what is it, the idea of, I mean, I like the bridge trees. We have bridge energy sources, and now we have bridge trees as well. But why do they think that they need, what was it, so like a 15 to 20-year period, and what would happen in that period that concerns you as far as losing that much more old-growth forest?
Well, right now we're seeing about 6 or 7 or so old-growth timber sales that are very big sales. One in particular is several thousand acres, and those sales would fragment and degrade a lot of the remaining intact blocks of old forest on the Tongass. And so time is of the essence. You know, we can't afford another 10 or 15 years of old-growth logging and still have an intact rainforest on the Tongass. And I think the Forest Service was basing their estimates on previous numbers until we took a look at the data set and analyzed it in a different way and sent them the information back that there's enough second growth or young growth out there right now to start phasing out of these old growth timber sales, and you already have a significant part of the bridge to a transitioned industry. You don't need to wait. And waiting will only make the situation more like what happened in the Pacific Northwest, which is what we're trying to avoid.
So what has been the response of the U.S. Forest Service and the Department of Agriculture to your proposal?
You know, I think initially there was a lot of doubt whether or not those areas actually existed on the ground. And we keep providing new information and new data analyses that I think is starting to turn some people's heads that, yeah, there is two possible choices out there. If the Forest Service continues to go the direction of old growth timber sales, they face a wall of litigation. If they go the other direction toward the young growth, they face the potential for a wall of wood that would come online within 5 years and start supplying the mills with a lot less controversy. What we don't know at this point is what is the economic value of those smaller trees, and we're in the process of working with the agency to test the lumber grade of what those younger trees might yield when they're put on the marketplace.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who is with the Geos Institute in Ashland, and he used to describe himself as a forest ecologist, but now what you term yourself more in terms of fighting climate change. Is that correct, Dominic?
Yeah, it's a little of both. I'm a jack of all trades. That's what you have to be in this business.
And you're listening to us here on KBOO on Locus Focus. You talk about retooling the industry. So it sounds like there's a lot more that needs to shift besides the logging practices. So how do you interface shifting logging practices with basically needing to retool all those mills that are right now geared towards cutting really large trees so that they can cut these smaller trees?
Yeah, I think that there's going to be the need for assisting those mills to make the jump to the 21st century milling technologies. And we've seen that as an example in the Northwest. A lot of the mills that survived the 80% reduction in old growth logging in the Pacific Northwest are the ones that were able to transition. They either got their supply from non-federal lands or they went small. And in this case, small is beautiful. So, you know, getting the mills into the more up-to-date technology is going to help with that transition, and we're going to have to find creative funding mechanisms and move appropriations from Congress around to get those mills up to speed.
Well, I was just thinking a few years ago, actually back when I met you, I was working on a project about the Biscuit Burn and the subsequent salvage logging that went on in the burn area after the fire in 2002. And I talked with the owners of Rough and Ready Lumber near Cave Junction, Oregon, and he was a big believer in getting in those logging trucks and salvage logging the burn, and we needed the wood. And meanwhile, I was told by other people that his mill was actually retrofitting itself so that it could mill much smaller logs. Though I understand that they went out of business recently. I'm not sure if that's correct. You might know more than I do about that.
But they're back.
Oh, they're jumping back. But I found it interesting that, at the same time he was talking about needing the large trees that they were going to get from the salvage logging, and that was all that would support the timber industry and the sawmills in Southern Oregon, that it seemed like he was already looking in another direction. And I'm wondering if how hard it is to change the mindset of the mill owners who have always been relying on these really big trees when they're faced with being told that they can't get access to those trees anymore.
Yeah, I think it's going to come down to a question of economics and jobs, which is what's really generating or motivating a lot of the demand to go into those areas. And so I think if you can demonstrate that the young growth is ready, there's enough of it out there, and it's marketable, and you can manufacture the material and provide jobs to the milling industry and associated value-added manufacturing, then I think you're beginning to build the case that, you know, they could still make a living, they could still make money off of these trees. And I think, importantly, the lack of controversy of using the younger forest, as we're seeing in places like the Sais Law, which has not had an appeal or litigation in many, many years since they moved into young growth, I think we could see the same thing in Alaska, where the trees go to the mills swiftly, and if the industry starts to invest in secondary manufacturing, then there could be a spike in the job market as well.
Well, right now, is there litigation going on in Alaska around cutting old growth in the Tongass? And is that slowing down the logging?
It is. And the logging has really come to an historic low on the Tongass. It's not been this low in many, many, many decades. And it's the result of, you know, the concerns about old growth. Those are very real and legitimate concerns that have slowed down the old growth volume that's coming off of the Tongass. And this is why we think there's an opportunity here. So if the Forest Service continues to go with the old growth sales, it's, again, you know, it's a wall of litigation. But if they go the direction of the young growth that's now coming online, it's potentially a wall of wood out there.
Well, I keep thinking about all the litigation that's still going on in the Mount Hood National Forest, and I'm sure there's, besides Swiss law, I have a feeling there's also issues in other national forests in Southern Oregon and Central Oregon. And it seems like it's really hard to change minds and to change practices and to change habits. And I wonder if you see hope for the shift to happen, not just up in the Tongass, but for that to be a model for other forests in the lower 48 states.
I think so. And I think it, you know, again, looking at the model from the Siuslaw National Forest in 1993, they were faced with a very similar situation. They were in a crisis mode. The spotted owl had just gotten listed. And, you know, we had the Northwest Forest Plan that was coming in. And so there was already a known reduction in logging that they were headed for. So why go that direction? I think the difference this time around is that we have an incredible opportunity to do it differently, to get to a more responsible forestry industry that is operating within the means and the capacity of what the forest can give. And we're protecting a resource that is of global significance, because there's just no place like the Tongass rainforest on Earth. And again, recognizing it for all its globally important values, I think the opportunity we have now that we didn't have in the last century is, let's get on this before we're in crisis mode and it's forced upon us as a result of listing new endangered species, because that's where it would head if we continue logging at the rate that, you know, the agency would like to do.
Now, how would you compare the disturbance in due to logging in the Tongass compared to the disturbances that we're so familiar with in the national forests in the Pacific Northwest?
You know, the Tongass is different because you don't have the fire issues up there, so it's temperate rainforest. And the kind of natural disturbances that happen up there are just basically a windstorm or a landslide or an avalanche. So it's not these big forest fires. So what happens on the Tongass now in terms of big disturbances is pretty much only landscape-level logging. And because of that, the Tongass has a relatively stable carbon source. So when these big trees are out there, they're taking atmospheric carbon dioxide out and they're storing it in their tree trunks and in the vegetation and in the soils. And so that storage will remain in those forests. You're keeping the carbon in the trees for centuries. And so they're providing us with a really important benefit as we're headed into an accelerated climate crisis. That forest is going to be increasingly important in holding on to atmospheric carbon for many, many decades to centuries. And if you log those forests, a lot of that stored carbon winds up into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide emissions.
So if you were going to fly, I mean, I'm thinking about flying over Mount Hood, and you basically see this checkerboard pattern that is maybe 50% clear cuts. I mean, it's actually quite shocking when you actually get up over Mount Hood as opposed to seeing it from the ground. And then if you're on the ground walking through forests in Mount Hood, you occasionally come upon old growth below timberline. How would you compare that to what it looks like both from the air and from the ground in the Tongass?
Well, clearly there are places on the Tongass that looked like that, but by and large, they're not the majority of the landscape. So you kind of flip the dynamic. So instead of seeing a bunch of holes, and especially this is the case if there's snow on the ground, they really stick out, those clear cuts. You can see them out the plane window very easily. And so what you see are these white blotches all over the landscape and little green patches, and that's the situation over Mount Hood and a lot of the Pacific Northwest. You go up to the Tongass, and it's the opposite. So you've got a lot more green, and you still have those patches of clear cuts, but you know, the opportunity is to keep it that way and not move it in the direction of what's happened down here, which resulted in crisis for the ecology and the economics of that of our region.
And we're still in that crisis. I mean, we are. Now, do you feel like that this region south of the 49th parallel is starting to come to terms with some of the same issues and rethinking logging practices down here?
You know, I'm optimistic that there has been a shift, particularly the social license to log old growth is gone. The difference today, though, is when we get a fire that goes through an area, it's, for some reason, it's a signal to the Forest Service and to politicians that all bets are off. It doesn't matter if it was protected before, they're going to still log it if a fire's gone through it. And because we've talked about this on some of your other shows, those burnt landscapes are incredibly rich in wildlife and legacy trees that are important in helping the forest regrow. And instead, what we're seeing is a rush to log them after a forest fire. And I think that's where a lot of the pressure is coming from now in the lower 48.
Well, actually, I just got an email from BARC, the organization that it's the self-appointed watchdog of the Mount Hood National Forest and protecting the remaining old growth stands from excessive logging, or probably from any logging. And I guess the latest bone of contention is the area along Highway 224 south of Estacada in the southern stretches of the Mount Hood National Forest where there was a big fire the end of last summer. And there are calls for going in and salvage logging that area to for fuel reduction. And the email points out that the fuel reduction happened. Nature did the fuel reduction with the fire.
Right.
But I wonder... I looked at that and I thought, oh, it seems like on a small scale, the biscuit all over again. So I wonder if you're at all following what's going on in that particular burn, or if that sounds kind of like this is business as usual throughout all the burns in Oregon.
I think that's what's happened. And I think the pattern that we're seeing is the bigger the fire, the bigger the logging proposal. And to give you a couple examples, we already talked about the biscuit. But the Rim Fire on the edge of Yosemite National Park, there was legislation to even go inside Yosemite and pull out burned trees. And, you know, we saw a massive logging proposal that came out from the Forest Service right after that burn. The same thing just happened on the Klamath National Forest down here in Northern California. Big fire and a huge logging proposal. And, you know, we're seeing it on the Mount Hood. And so this is really the direction I think that the logging is headed in our region, particularly as climate change results in increasing drought stress in many places of the West. We're going to see more of these fires, and as a result, the bigger threat by far is the post-fire logging that happens and not the fires themselves, because those tend to be ecologically beneficial to the forests that need those fires.
Well, 3 years ago, I think there was a big fire on the north face of Mount Hood, the Dollar Lake Fire. And the next year, I was up hiking on the Vista Ridge Trail, which cuts right through the heart of that burn. And I was rather intrigued and gratified to see these signs as soon as you enter the wilderness area, which was happily expanded only 2 years before the fire. So the wilderness area starts like a mile into the Vista Ridge Trail. And there were signs all over saying, this is wilderness area, do not remove trees. So I thought, well, I guess they're not going to do any post-fire burning here. And I haven't been up there since to see for sure, but it did seem like there was a very different mindset about this particular burn than it's certainly around the biscuit, which I have been very aware of. So I wonder if you're aware of other places where there is actually less of a push now for post-fire logging.
The only places I'm aware of is, as you mentioned, inside wilderness areas. But
so you still can't go in there.
Yeah, that's the rule of thumb. Mm. The agency has gotten increasingly bold with these large fires, and it's really a tragedy in the making, because those areas are so important to fire-dependent species that from the standpoint of a blackback woodpecker or plant or mushrooms that depend on those older trees that have either survived the fire or were killed by the fire, you know, restoration happened the moment the fire came through. And to go in there and log and call that restoration, when in fact it's degrading the area and actually setting it up for an even more severe burn next time. And the way that happens is that the logging results in taking the least flammable material out of the forest. These are the trees that already were burnt. And instead you get more logging slash that's left on the ground. And that's what's going to burn up in the next fire. It's not those big trees that have already lost most of their living vegetation. It's the material that's left on the ground that acts as kindling the next time a fire comes through, and that blows up.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who's with the Geos Institute in Ashland, and we're talking about protecting the amazing expanse of temperate rainforest up in Alaska, known as the Tongass National Forest, and we're talking about how that compares to the lack of protection for our temperate rainforests here in the Pacific Northwest, and we've been talking a little bit about the concerns about post-fire logging and the damage that's doing, being that that's the only old growth logging that we're still doing. I wonder, Dominic, if people in the timber industry are beginning to think or realize that in the Tongass you still have the opportunity to protect the old growth forest. That if it continues to be logged as it's been logged here in Oregon and Washington in Northern California, that there'll come a point where they're going to still have to transition to logging secondary growth because there'll be no more old growth. Is that an argument that's being made, and is that being received at all?
You know, I don't think that folks are looking at it that way, honestly, and I think it's just because, like it must have been 50 or 60 years ago in the Pacific Northwest, you know, when you look at the Tongass, it looks like the amount of old growth is limitless. You know, there's still 6 million acres of old growth forest on, you know, a 17 million acre national forest. So it looks like there's a lot of old growth out there. So the issue of time perspective and scale is not one that's winning the day up there, because they don't have the kind of perspective that we do in terms of what happened with the Pacific Northwest, when we also had a lot of old growth. And it only took us, you know, 5 or 6 decades to knock that back to crisis mode. And so what we're trying to do at this point is to get ahead of that transition and have it happen while there's still a lot of old growth left.
Well, I keep thinking about British Columbia, the interior British Columbia, particularly in the northern part of the province, where it's a similar landscape to the Tongass, and it has been an immense amount of acreage of temperate rainforest that was at one time largely undisturbed, but that's changed in the last 20 years. And now they do helicopter logging and go to these really remote places. And I've seen aerial photographs of vast, vast expanses of clear cuts up there. Is that lurking in the back of your mind, is like, this could be the future of the Tongass if we don't change practices really very soon?
Absolutely. And, you know, fortunately, the Great Bear Rainforest, which is also one of the world's 6 remaining intact, relatively intact rainforest, temperate rainforest, they have made some progress on the conservation side. There's the Great Bear Rainforest Agreement. It wasn't perfect, but it certainly increased the amount of protection that we're seeing on the Great Bear, and, you know, pretty much dramatically revised the way they're cutting trees up there. They're doing it in a more benign way, and they're still different components of that agreement that need to be worked out in negotiations, but it has shifted the industry more in a transition mode. And if it had not happened, we would have seen, you know, the Pacific Northwest in terms of the crisis being extended to British Columbia.
However, the Great Bear rainforest is being proposed as being the through route for the Northern Gateway pipeline to carry tar sands oil to Kitimat.
Yep.
And
that's
if that,
really unfortunate.
Yeah. So it seems like we've got battles on many, many fronts. And if it's not clear cutting, then it's pipelines.
Yes, and you know, it really comes down to we need to get in the hurry-up offense in terms of how we're responding to the impending climate crisis. You know, I also have to point to what happened at the recent UN Climate Summit in New York, where 157 entities, including governments, corporations, conservation groups, indigenous groups, all signed on to a declaration to slow the rate of global deforestation by 2020 and strive to end global deforestation by 2030. The U.S. was one of the signatories on that declaration. Now, whether or not it has any teeth to it is another subject, but at least in principle, the government signed on to ending deforestation by 2030. What better place to demonstrate that than the Tongass rainforest?
Well, as we get into politics, my mind goes back to last Tuesday and a rather disturbing election for anybody concerned with climate change or protecting the environment. And, I mean, the Senate race in Alaska is still not called, though it looks like it's probably going to go to the Republican. Are you concerned that with the political shift in Washington, it might make the case for stopping the old growth logging in the Tongass a more difficult challenge?
Yeah, there's always that. You know, there's always the pressure that the administration's going to feel from members of Congress that may view the transition as happening too quickly. And we have been in discussions with the Alaska delegation, just showing them what's going on, and hopefully that will hold in terms of allowing the transition to go forward and allowing it to happen quickly. And again, I think it comes down to just showing people, we're hoping that this is a bipartisan initiative, because the amount of tree volume going to the mills would actually increase if they avoided the old growth, and there would be a slight increase in the number of jobs. And at the same time, the size of the logging footprint would drop substantially. I know that sounds a little bit odd. How could you have increased volume and increased jobs and a smaller footprint? But it's mostly because of whatever old growth is put up on the Tongass is winding up in litigation or appeals. So they're not getting what they're thinking they're going to get because they don't have the social license to log those forests anymore.
Well, I know that you've been going back and forth to Washington a lot. And in fact, you were supposed to be on the show a few weeks ago and you were in Washington, D.C. at the time. So I'm wondering what you've been busy going back to Washington for and how that is looking.
Yeah, mainly presenting the information to the Department of Agriculture and the Forest Service, basically just taking their data sets and showing them, walking them through the fact that they've got enough young growth on their landscape to start that transition, have it in the forest plan amendment before Obama leaves office so that it's well underway by the time the next administration comes in. The thing that I worry about is if it takes another 10 to 15 years from now, you know, who knows who's going to be in the White House and who's going to be in Congress. And so we've got a receptive administration, and, you know, the clock is ticking. So we're in hurry-up offense to try to get this into the Tongass plan amendment so that it becomes the way the Forest Service transitions, and that transition happens, you know, when Obama leaves office.
Actually, just before I left for the station, I was looking at this email I got from Obama, or from it's the Organizing for America group with Obama signing it. And I'm trying to remember what the issue was, but it was a very progressive issue, which Obama is wanting to move ahead on. And I'm thinking maybe because he realizes that there is no way to work with Congress anymore, and he's no longer trying to be as bipartisan as he failed to be, that maybe he is fired up to do some things that would be perceived as being a little bit more, if not radical, at least more proactive. And I'm wondering if you're hopeful that there will be some things that will happen much more quickly now that there's only 2 years left to his administration.
Yeah, I have to remain hopeful in this business, Barbara. I have a 9-year-old, so, You know, I've got to have a hope that we will get to the point where we are treating the planet in a much better way as stewards instead of wrecking the place. And I think that, you know, the president has made it pretty clear that if Congress doesn't act, he will. And so we're setting up the situation that will allow the administration to go forward with a transition before the president leaves office. We want that wrapped up. It may not happen right away, but you can't wait another 10 to 15 years. And we're hoping that by showing them the path forward, that they will be bold enough to have a leadership role, which would not only be nationally significant, but it would demonstrate to the rest of the world that the United States is taking climate change and the impending climate crisis as serious, and they're ready to lead on it.
Now, do you think if this can happen in the Tongass, that it can happen in the Mount Hood National Forest, the Willamette National Forest, and other forests throughout Oregon and Washington?
Well, stay tuned on that one, because we're eventually going to see a Northwest Forest Plan 2.0. And the Forest Service already is talking about revising the Northwest Forest Plan. And so we're hoping that as administrations change hands, and we're not sure who that's going to be in 2017, and as the Northwest Forest Plan is revised, that they will continue the forward progress that the Clinton administration made by building on the Northwest Forest Plan by addition and not subtraction.
Well, Dominic, it's always good talking with you. I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning.
You bet. Thanks for having me on again.
And I'm sure you'll be back soon.
Okay.
We've been talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala with the Geos Institute in Ashland, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guest is Bill Powers, who's author of a book called New Slow City, about living simply, sustainably, and slowly in, of all places, New York City. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Ricky Lee Jones. Thanks for listening.
Drive by it each day on my way to and from work. There are always flowers left there each day, left for a child who died there, a soul that is what people say. Looks back at me. Left by someone. Left by someone. Left by someone.
Given how rapidly technology is changing, it's hard sometimes to tell whether the change is for the better or for the worse. One current problem in Portland is a direct result of the growth of the tech industry, rising rents, and gentrification. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for future trends in technology and the current housing crisis in Portland. The final part in Startup City, how the new tech boom is changing Portland.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rajasthani Gypsy Caravan. Performance on Sunday, November 16th at 6 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. The Rajasthani Gypsy Caravan aims to promote, preserve, and share their culture. Their performance will include colorful costumes and elements of the Rajasthani arts of the spinning dance of the snake charmer, devotional singing, unusual instruments, storytelling, and ancient love songs. The caravan will also be joined by local performers Sedona Soulfire and Paul Evans. Again, that's Rajasthani Gypsy Caravan, Sunday, November 16th at 6 p.m., Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it's just a few seconds past 11 a.m. here at KBOO Portland. Coming right up is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. He speaks with herbal expert Stephen Herod Buhner, who explains the roots of antibiotic resistance and explores the value of herbal treatments. And at 11:30 on the radio zine, Tessie Word, KBOO's 2014 Artist in Residence, talks about her piece, Convergence, and her beginnings in sound design, and about the experience of being a KBOO artist in residence. And we want to thank our KBOO members for your support for community radio. If you missed our recent membership drive, you can still become a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Stephen Herod Buhner, is a national and international speaker on herbal medicine, emerging diseases, and complex interrelationships and ecosystems. He's the author of many books, including